tomorrow, gentlemen. We'll be in Las Vegas.
Welcome to Vegas.
Las Vegas functions on a 24-hour-a-day schedule.
The pools, the casino.
Big volcano out in front.
That's the Eiffel Tower.
Bellagio. Riviera.
The Mirage.
Flamingo.
Sahara.
The MGM Grand.
This isn't the real Caesar's Palace, is it?
On a camel.
They always put the machines that pay off the most right in the front.
Good luck.
Strip is just the most amazing stretch of road, I think, probably anywhere in the world.
Kicking ass in Vegas.
Vegas, baby.
Vegas, baby.
Welcome to Las Vegas.
You know what I've been doing a lot lately, and it's not very stereotypically me, is that I've been trying to spend a lot more time outside. So come morning, you know, I'll do whatever chores I got to do, whatever it's on my docket. The problem that I always tend to run into is that I get bored when I'm outside. It's always the same problem I have when I'm poolside in Vegas. So What I've been able to do is I now take the Mac outside with me, and all of a sudden being outside is pretty awesome.
Yeah, you have something to do.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Which is why our listeners have seen so many videos and various other things come to fruition that have been on my things to do list, and now that I'm outside going, hey, I'm outside and I'm getting things done. Doesn't feel like work when I'm outside.
No, it shouldn't.
So we are in for yet another special treat this evening.
Oh, what was that? Hot mic.
Hot mic. Syphilis. Syphilis.
Unique New York. Unique New York.
So it's time for another Vintage Vegas.
Yes, it is. And tonight whenever it is that you're listening to this, you're going to be enjoying kind of the next point of origin in our story, kind of leaving off from Billy Wilkerson and moving into something a little different.
Yeah, honestly, Billy Wilkerson has been
the guy that just kind of comes in our storyline and just kind of kicks the doors in for everything else.
Yeah, and now it's time to take it to the next step, although Billy is still, of course, in some way connected to this. So,
right.
Let's get into it.
Yep.
Unlike the Flamingo and Billy Wilkerson, the Desert Inn was a dream come to fruition for Wilbur Clark. Years of development, planning, construction made into a reality, even if everything didn't go exactly as planned. As with many big dreamers, ambition can sometimes outlast finances, which was the case for Wilbur Clark and his Desert Inn.
Mo Dalitz was a man with a dream as well, legitimacy. Las Vegas offered the opportunity to apply his gambling business acumen legally and in public as well. When his friend Meyer Lansky informed him of the financial problems the Desert Inn had encountered preventing the project from being completed, he jumped at the opportunity to invest.
The deal between Wilbur and Mo gave majority ownership to Dalitz, but kept Wilbur in place as a partner as well as the legitimate face of the property. It may be the first and only true partnership between organized crime owners and the legitimate frontman. In most cases, the guy out front was little more than a bullied puppet with little to no input on operations. In the case of Wilbur and Moe, the Desert Inn partnership would go on to make them both very rich men. Wilbur Clark was a high school dropout. At 19, he hitchhiked from Keysport, Illinois to San Diego to see his father. Along the way, he found work when he needed money, wherever he was. One of those jobs was as a dishwasher in a cafe in Las Vegas, Arizona. When Wilbur was ready to move on, the owner gave him a silver dollar and told him if he kept it, he would never be broke. Legend has it that Wilbur kept that silver dollar for the rest of his life.
Wilbur's first experience in the casino business was back in 1931 when he became a craps dealer at the Reno, Nevada Bank Club. Wilbur really enjoyed the casino industry and quickly made a point of learning everything they would teach him about it. So he began to save his money and make advantageous friendships.
In 1938, he took over as owner of the Green Shack Restaurant on Fremont Street, located across the street from Vegas's first casino resort, Tony Cornero's The Meadows. Despite the Green Shack's success, Clark didn't see many business opportunities in Las Vegas. After owning the Green Shack less than a year, he sold it in 1938 and bought restaurant bars in Reno and California. Continuing to diversify, in 1939, Clark was reported as being one of the investors in Tony Cornero's SS Rex gambling ship. Once the gambling ship operation was closed down and the SS Rex sold, Wilbur went back to Vegas in 1944.
Wilbur liked Las Vegas during the brief time he owned the Green Shack, but didn't have the kind of bankroll nor ambition at the time to build in a market that still hadn't had its first resort constructed on Highway 91. Even though he decided to leave Vegas, he kept an eye on it because he saw it had potential. After the success of the El Rancho, Frontier, and Flamingo, Wilbur decided to return to Vegas and get in on the action.
His first move in Vegas was to buy the El Rancho from Thomas Hall. Next, he purchased the Monte Carlo Club on Fremont Street. With so many casino clubs in close proximity on Fremont Street, Wilbur was looking for a way to have his club stand out. So he designed the first sign in Vegas with a flickering light. But more than anything, Wilbur wanted to build his own resort. To raise the capital for the project, he sold his interest in the El Rancho and Monte Carlo Club for $1.5 million. In 1945, he purchased the Players Club and the 16 acres of land around it on Highway 91, across the street from the Frontier, for $75,000. In 1946, some say 1947, construction began on the Desert Inn.
Wilbur hired Wayne McAllister to design and build the Desert Inn. McAllister was already well known for his work on casino resorts, including the remodel of the El Rancho and eventually the Sands and the Fremont. Clark envisioned a chic property that would compete for the same clientele as the Flamingo. However, it didn't take long before Wilbur's ambition outlasted his finances, and the project came to a halt in 1947.
After pouring $2.39 million into the project, Clark ran out of money. With banks unwilling to do business or give loans to casinos, owners really had no other option for financing than organized crime. As months turned into a year, the unfinished project sat in the Las Vegas desert for so long that, like today's Echelon and Fontainebleau project, it became the butt of jokes, even being referred to as Clark's Folly in the Desert. Enter Mo Dalitz.
Mo Dalitz was born in Boston, Massachusetts. He was raised in Michigan, where his family owned a laundry service. Like many men of opportunity during Prohibition, Mo Dalitz was a bootlegger and a racketeer. He used the family laundry trucks and barges to help smuggle booze into the country from Canada across Lake Erie. To avoid getting caught, Dalitz would throw the whiskey overboard, but used floating buoys to mark where they were dropped so he could retrieve them later on.
But Mo was a true businessman and used the profits from his business, both legal and illegal, to expand. He invested in linen supply, steel, realty, and railroads in Ohio, Michigan, and Illinois. He also opened several illegal casinos, including the Pettibone Club, the Jungle Inn, and the Lookout House. Years later, during an interview, Dalitz remarked, "How was I to know that gambling joints were illegal? There were so many judges and politicians in them, I figured they had to be all right."
During this time of the expansion, Mo relocated to Cleveland, Ohio. There he ran a criminal organization of Jewish American gangsters called the Cleveland Syndicate, known for being extremely violent. Being a man of vision, Mo was able to merge the Cleveland Syndicate with other major organized crime gang in Cleveland, the Mayfield Road Mob, to form the leading underworld organization in Cleveland.
While Mo was running the family laundry operations, like so many businesses of the time, he struggled to keep his laundries from unionizing. This is how he met Jimmy Hoffa, future president of the Teamsters Union. The two quickly developed a friendship, and some say Hoffa even recruited the Mayfield gang as the muscle to force unionization with other businesses in Cleveland.
In 1940, during World War II, Dalitz joined the Army, rising to the rank of second lieutenant. When the war was over, Mo went back to business as usual, however, found it much harder to continue to run illegal gambling joints.
History groups Dalitz in the same infamy as Meyer Lansky and Bugsy Siegel. In fact, Meyer and Mo were longtime friends. However, some believe the only fair comparison to make between the two would be their financial genius. Some believe the friendship with Meyer is how Mo learned of Wilbur's need for money to complete the Desert Inn.
Unlike many who came to Vegas to operate in legitimacy, some argue Dalitz made the transition better than most. While many used casinos as a legitimate front, some believe Dalitz really wanted to take the chance Nevada was offering to use his skills legally. The problem with this logic is there's no reason to believe that Mo didn't participate in skimming, which removed millions of dollars from the casinos before it could be counted and reported as revenue to the IRS.
So Mo Dalitz jumped at the opportunity to buy into the Desert Inn. He came in and gave Wilbur $3.6 million to complete the project in exchange for a 74% interest in the property.
The majority of the financing came from the American National Insurance Company, which believed to be indirectly affiliated with the Cleveland Syndicate. Dalitz got the rest of the $3.6 million from the Teamsters Union, making the first time the Teamsters Union financed the construction of a Las Vegas casino. It would not be the last.
Despite being a minority owner, part of the deal was that Wilbur would stay on and be the face of the company as well as the owner on record. Mo even allowed the property signage to stay Wilbur Clark's Desert Inn.
When construction started back up again in 1949, Wilbur didn't ask McAllister to return the project. Instead, he brought in Hugh Taylor, a 25-year-old non-licensed architect who was short on experience. It isn't really clear why, but odds are it was Mo's decision. It took 4 years to build the Desert Inn and about $6.5 million. It's estimated that it only cost an additional $750,000 to finish the actual construction. The remainder of the $3 million loan was to furnish the place and fund operations. Before the opening, Life magazine did a piece on the property and what it takes to run a casino. Anticipation for the new resort was at a fever pitch.
On April 24th, 1950, the 300-room Desert Inn opened as the fifth casino resort on the Las Vegas Strip. Wilbur greeted guests on opening night with flowers from a Joshua tree in the property's lobby. He couldn't have appeared happier. For opening night, Clark wanted an all-out marketing blitz, so he recruited the help of Hank Greenspun, who would go on to found the Las Vegas Sun newspaper. They invited all major newspapers and magazines to come so the grand opening would get national coverage. They even paid an estimated $5,700 to fly press out to attend the grand opening. Three radio stations covered the opening, and two newspapers had full-page ads in them. The ads informed guests to, quote, come as informally as you like. Remember, it's still the Old West, even though you're in the glamorous setting of Wilbur Clark's Desert Inn. Another 150 invitations were sent out to VIPs who were offered a $10,000 credit limit. At the grand opening, 50% of the people in attendance were from places other than Nevada and California.
Of the various amenities offered, the Desert Inn had a new professional 450-seat entertainment venue named the Painted Desert Room, which doubled as a dining room. It offered a New York steak dinner for $5.75 and a baked lobster and filet mignon for $7.50, which would equate to $53.70 respectively in 2011. It was also reported that the chef at the Desert Inn was once the chef for the Duke of Windsor. Opening acts included ventriloquist Edgar Bergen and his dummy Charlie McCarthy, as well as the Don Arden dancers. Opening night entertainment cost Wilbur $50,000, with $25,000 alone going to Edgar Bergen.
The Desert Inn Casino was 2,400 square feet, one of the largest in Nevada at the time. The carpet was $10,000 and featured woven patterns of four-leaf clovers, horseshoes, and playing cards. The property had a bar with a wheel on the wall featuring a 90-foot nude Lady Luck. The wheel had numbers on it corresponding to the numbers of seats at the bar. Every hour they would spin it, and the person sitting on the chair with the same number as the wheel landed on would win a silver dollar. The property had 60 employees, 5 craps tables, 3 roulette wheels, 4 blackjack tables, and 75 slot machines. They also had a sports book. The Desert Inn had several things that had not been seen in Las Vegas yet, including a roulette wheel that Clark helped design to improve player visibility.
On opening weekend, the Desert Inn lost $87,000 in an 8-hour shift, $36,000 to one gambler alone. However, this served as a great advertisement for the new property. When word got out, people flocked to the property to get on the action, and by the next weekend, the Desert Inn had recouped all of its losses. Opening night brought $750,000 to the tables alone. In the first month, the revenues from the bar totaled $90,000. In fact, the only thing that didn't at least break even was the dining and showroom, which was expected considering the cost of the entertainment Wilbur chose to bring in.
An idea for a lounge was born from a trip Wilbur took to San Francisco's Mark Hopkins Hotel, which had the Top of the Mark Lounge located, as one would guess, at the top of the hotel. Wilbur decided he wanted something just like it. He would name it the Sky Room. The Sky Room was a three-story lounge that was glass enclosed on three sides and was promoted as the largest building in town. However, that fact was never verified as true. Stars made up of tiny lights were set up in the ceiling among faux clouds and would twinkle, giving the effect of a night sky. From the Sky Room, you could see the hotel, the pool, the property grounds, and the golf course once it was built. Later, when nuclear bomb testing went on 65 miles away from the Strip, the Sky Room was a very popular place to watch the show.
The Desert Inn's trademark logo was a desert scene with a large Joshua tree cactus. The signage was built by the Young Electric Sign Company, who also built Vegas Vic, the Silver Slipper, and most recently the Wind Strip Marquee with the moving eraser feature. The Desert Inn sign wasn't much more than the day sign outlined in neon. The Joshua Tree Cactus was named after early Mormon settlers said its angular branches reminded them of the outstretched arms of the prophet Joshua.
The Desert Inn had an oval, all-white flagstone fountain at the front of the property, spraying water 60 feet high. Twice a night, it displayed the Dancing Water Show with thousands of water jets and multicolored lights choreographed to music. The attraction was free of charge and predates the Fountains of Bellagio by 40 years.
Yeah, a little known fact I'm sure most people aren't aware of.
Yeah.
The standard rooms at the Desert Inn were a modern take on Western decor, but the Hollywood Suites offered a large living room, two separate bedrooms, and lavish designs. All rooms had thermostats, private showers, and outside exposure. The furniture was designed to give a Western or ranch appearance. They had bright rugs and colored tiles. The rooms were described as homey with very comfortable beds.
All rooms were deliberately positioned so that guests would either have a view of the landscape or the pool. Some rooms even had private patios that faced the pool. The Desert Inn offered an Olympic-sized swimming pool in the shape of a figure eight. As part of its decor, the pool area also had an arch, similar, but not nearly as large or functional, to the one in St. Louis, which was built 17 years later in 1967. The property featured such amenities as a lady shop, a men's shop, a barber and beauty salon, a gift shop, a drugstore called the Pillbox, and a coffee shop that overlooked the pool.
On the north end of the property, six rooms were set aside named the Kachina Del Ranch, specifically designed to cater to the family tourists. The ranch had a child care center staffed by a trained psychologist with a playroom, cribs, and complete playground. Each room had a mural depicting lessons and manners.
One of the unique amenities the Desert Inn had was its own golf course surrounded by residences on the property. November 1951, construction began on the 18-hole golf course laid out over 272 acres of property. When Hank Greenspun left the Desert Inn to start the Las Vegas Sun newspaper, Gene Murphy was brought in to be the marketing director for the property. Gene would end up bringing the PGA Tournament of Champions to Las Vegas and the Desert Inn golf course.
The Desert Inn cleared $2 million in net profit in its first year of operations, and that was only what was reported after the skim. After a first year of operation, the Desert Inn was the top casino in Las Vegas, surpassing the Golden Nugget. The success of the Desert Inn earned Wilbur the nickname Little Caesar.
In 1951, the Desert Inn received its phone number, 6,000.
A year after the Desert Inn opened, the Kefauver hearings began. During the Kefauver hearings, Wilbur Clark was asked, quote, "Before you go in beds with crooks to finish this proposition, didn't you look into these birds at all?" Clark replied, quote, "Not too much. No, sir."
When it was Moe's turn, his wealth was brought into question, specifically where he got the money to invest in his various other legitimate operations, going as far as being outright accused of getting the money from rum running during the Prohibition. Moe's reply was, quote, "Well, I didn't inherit any money, Senator." He went on to say that if people like you didn't drink it, I wouldn't have provided it.
In the first 3 years, the Desert Inn spent $2.13 million on entertainment. Don Arden, who most would know from the long-running show Jubilee at Bally's, wrote and directed Hello America for the Desert Inn when it opened in 1950.
Frank Sinatra made his Las Vegas debut in the Painted Desert show.
We hope you've enjoyed this premium content preview. For access to the rest of this episode, as well as all the premium content we offer, go to patreon.com/360Vegas. A monthly subscription will give you access to the enhanced version of the podcast, often with bonus content, exclusive podcasts like 360 Vintage Vegas, 360 Origins, 360 Vegas Movies, insider information on all things 360 Vegas, 360 Vegas Vacation, and early access to everything. To subscribe, simply go to patreon.com/360Vegas. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. Or you can find a link to Patreon on our blog, 360VegasPodcast.com.